space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? The symbols representing all the elements around us. Bright minds known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
Well, thank you very much for your kind introduction. I'm really proud to be part of this set of public lectures for the opening of this wonderful Physics Institute. And I'm grateful for all the people who contributed to making this institute possible. And I hope, I'm sure that lots of new physics and very interesting physics will come out of this institute. Okay. So I'll be talking about some aspects of black holes, but before talking about black holes directly, I want to sort of give some of the historical background for the modern discussion of black holes. And so I need to remind you of some aspects of gravitation, remind you of some aspects of special relativity, general relativity, and some aspects of quantum mechanics. So that will be the beginning of my talk, and then we'll discuss some of the more modern developments in black hole physics, in some theoretical aspects of black holes. So let's start talking about Newton's theory of gravity. So that's the theory of gravity you studied in high school. So according to this theory, we're used to the notion of gravity, and we're used to the fact that if you throw something up, it will come back down again. But this theory predicts that if you throw something up really very fast, it will not come up, it will not come down again. And that's why things can be in orbit, and that's why we can send spacecraft to other planets and so on, is that if we give enough initial velocity to some particle, it will just can escape the gravitational field of the Earth. And that's because the gravitational force decreases with distance. Now, French physicist Pierre-Simon Laplace asked himself, what would happen if an object is so massive and so compact that this escape velocity is the velocity of light? So what would happen if you need to throw something out with velocity faster than light in order to escape the gravitational field of the body? Then what would happen is that this object would look black. I mean, no light would come out of this object. Now, this is a very small distance for very massive objects. And so you can calculate what it is according to the formulas of Newtonian gravity. And so in order to give you an idea, so in order for an object to be a black hole, if the object has the mass of the sun, this radius would have to be of the order of 3 kilometers. And if it's an object of the mass of the Earth, it would have to be of a radius of order of 1 centimeter. So if you were to put all the mass of the Earth in a radius of order 1 centimeter, you would construct one of these black holes. And for an ordinary object of ordinary masses, let's say a mass of 100 kilograms, this radius, the radius at which you would, the size that you need to compress this object to, would be smaller than any distance we can experimentally measure today. Okay? So this is according to Newtonian gravity. And when this was initially observed, this was a forgotten curiosity. Nobody paid any attention to this. But later, there were certain developments that occurred later, such as the theory of special relativity, which say that the velocity of light is not just some random velocity. It's really a fundamental constant of nature. It's the maximum velocity at which you can transfer information, at which information can propagate. And this theory of relativity says that physics, the laws of physics, are also independent of how you are moving. So it's independent of whether we are moving relative to another person. So if you are on a train that is moving relative to the ground, the laws of physics you measure with that doing experiments on this train are independent of the velocity which the train is traveling. Now, this is true even for the fundamental constant of nature, such as the velocity of light. So that means that the velocity of light is the same for you traveling on the train as it is for somebody moving, sitting on the ground. Now, this is something very counterintuitive. And if you don't find this counterintuitive, it's because I'm not explaining it clearly enough. So if you you have another train, let's say, moving at the same speed that you're moving, the second train is not traveling. As if it is moving a little faster, it has a different speed. So ordinarily, the speed of different objects depend on the speed you are moving. Okay? So the speed of you relative to somebody else will depend on the speed that other object is moving. That's not so for the velocity of light. So the velocity of light is the same for everybody. So if you are inside the train and you shine a flashlight, then the velocity that you measure on the train is the same as the velocity you measure on the ground. So this should be counterintuitive, and it is indeed. And the reason, the only way this can happen is because time flows differently for different observers. So when they measure the velocity, they need to measure a distance and a time, and that time is different for the two observers. So time flows differently depending on how you're moving. And so space and time form some unity. So the thing that is constant is really space and time. And how we perceive space or how we perceive time depends on how we move. So that was one aspect that we need to put in our discussion of black holes. The other aspect has to do with some features of gravity. So the first feature was discovered by Galileo, which is the fact that all objects fall exactly in the same way, independently of their masses, if you remove the effects of the resistance of the air. Of course, our intuition from everyday life would be that a lighter object follows more slowly than a heavy object. I mean, if you throw a piece of paper, it will follow more slowly than a piece of rock. But that's entirely due to the resistance of the air. If you remove the resistance of the air, then everything falls in the same way. Now, so this is saying that the gravitational force is exactly proportional to the mass. And this is really not the case for other forces. So if you have an electric force, an electric field will attract an electrically charged particle, and it will not attract some particle that is not electrically charged. And so the motion of these two particles in an electric field will be different. Now, the motions of particles in a gravitational field is the same for all particles. So that's a fundamental property of gravity. Now, the theory of special relativity was developed and found in the beginning of the 20th century in 1905. And Einstein realized, well, many people realized, that Newtonian gravity is not consistent with special relativity. Because in Newtonian gravity, the gravitational force between two particles is proportional to the instantaneous position of the two objects. So if I were to move this object a little bit, then the other object would immediately know, due to the gravitational force, that you moved this original object. So you need to modify the theory somehow. And what Einstein proposed is that gravity is really due to the curvature of space-time. So that gravity is due to the fact that space-time is not just a flat, rigid object where things happen, but it's something curved. And this curvature affects how other particles move in this space-time. So one useful analogy to keep in mind is think of space-time as a rubber sheet that you stretch. And if you put some heavy object on this rubber sheet, it will deform the rubber sheet according to its mass. So the heavier it is, the more it will deform it. And then if you throw a second particle, let's say you throw a marble on this rubber sheet, this marble will move according to the local shape of the of this rubber sheet. So in a similar way, a light particle, so a particle that is not as heavy as the original particle, will move in the space-time following the trajectory of minimal length in that curved space-time. So this is the trajectory that closest approximates, which is the natural analogous to a straight line in a curved geometry. So really, gravity is not an ordinary force. It's really a very interesting force because it's the force that deforms the actual geometry of space-time. It's the, space-time is sort of the more most fundamental concept, which is where things happen. I mean, in other forces we describe as particles colliding in this space-time and so on. Like that's how it is we describe electric forces and so on. But gravity is more, it's very basic. It's really just about the shape of this space-time. So when we have particles, we modify the shape. When we put massive particles, we modify the shape of this space-time. And that's what gravity is all about. It's about describing this shape of space-time. So there are some precise equations behind these pictures that tell us how, given some masses, how, what the geometry of space-time is. So we, there are some formulas from which you can calculate all these quantities. Now, we mentioned before that time depends on how you're moving. And the flow of time also depends on the gravitational field. So if you're in the gravitational field of the Earth, the time will flow differently for different observers, even if they are not moving with relative to each other. So for example, suppose that we have a person in the basement of a building and a person in the top floor of the building. And so the time will flow differently for these two people. So in other words, if we initially synchronize their clocks, so they synchronize their clocks so that let's say it's 12 a.m. for both of them, then some time goes by. And after some time, they decide to compare their clocks. And the observer in the top floor will think that more time has elapsed for him for her than the observer in the bottom floor. Now, this, for an ordinary building, here on Earth, this is a very, very tiny effect. It's an effect of 1 part in 10 to the 15. It's a very tiny effect, but it's an effect that can actually be measured and was measured. So if you have a precise enough clock, you can actually measure this effect. And there are various tricks to do this, and this has been done.
What is the distance between this clock for this time?
Well, it's around 10 meters. Okay, so you can define some facts, something called the redshift factor, which is really the ratio of the flow of time at the position far away from a very heavy object to the flow of time at some position. I mean, so the idea is, suppose you have a very heavy object and you have nothing far away. So far away, there is some natural notion of time. And as you get closer to this heavy object, the gravitational field is becoming stronger and stronger. And so time, if you are sitting at the fixed position, time for you will flow more slowly. And if you compare the clock ticking at some position relative to the clock, to the rate at which clocks tick far away, you define a quotient, and that's the redshift factor. It's how much lower time flows for you. So just to give you an idea of what this is for various massive objects, so if we have, let's say, a clock at the surface of the sun relative to a clock far away, the clock at the surface will go slower by a factor of roughly 2 in a million. So if you wait for a week, it will clock, let's say, 1 second less than a clock that is will mark, it will give you a time that is 1 second less than a clock very far away. Here on the surface of the Earth, that's even a smaller factor. But for some astronomical bodies, this could be a very large effect. So for example, on the surface of the star, or of a neutron star, which these neutron stars are very compact compact stars. They're almost on the verge of forming black holes. So on this, on this surface of the neutron stars, a clock could tick, let's say, at 70% of the rate that the clock ticks far away. So this is a very significant effect. So soon after Einstein wrote down his equations, a German mathematician and physicist computed the solution or computed the geometry that you would have outside a massive body. So he solved these equations and found a particular geometry, which is the geometry that would exist outside the star, for example. In order to know the geometry inside the star, then you would have to take into account the mass of the star and so on, and that's a more complicated problem. But we will not discuss the geometry inside, we'll just for the moment discuss the geometry outside. And once you know this geometry, geometry, you can compute how time flows at some position relative to how time flows far away. All this information is captured by the geometry of space-time. And what you find is that some simple formula, but what this, if you don't follow these formulas, it doesn't matter. If you are not used to formulas, don't worry about it. I'm just going to plot a little graph of what this is. So this little curve here is, so this is the position far from the star. This is the surface of the star. This is the center of the star. And this curve is just telling us how time slows down. So when this is one, it means time hasn't slowed down at all. And as this gets smaller, that means that time will slow down more and more. So if we have a very small star that is very massive, so here I kept the mass of the star constant and we made the star smaller and smaller. So as we do that, then time starts flowing more and more slowly as you make the star smaller and smaller, keeping its mass constant. Now something quite dramatic and surprising happens when you make the star sufficiently small. What happens is that at some position, which actually is given by the same formula in terms of the mass that the classical black hole radius we defined before is, so after solving, which is this formula, so proportional to the mass, so these are the same numbers that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. So when something becomes smaller than that, then it looks like time comes to a halt. So here time is not flowing at all. So here you can have a million years, and here it's just time hasn't flowed for you at all. So it's like the flow of time comes to a standstill on this surface. So this is a very surprising feature of this very surprising prediction of Einstein's theory of relativity. And when this was first found, it was believed to be a mathematical curiosity, a singularity that was due to the approximations, because you approximated the object as being spherical, or because you didn't take everything into account. Maybe you couldn't make an object so small. And so there are many ways in which this might not actually arise. And even Einstein himself thought that this singularity was maybe a product of some approximation and so on, and that it would go away in the actual theory. Now, the work of many people then showed that this is not so. In fact, there are stars that could collapse into black holes. So matter, there is no force that could balance the strong gravitational force for some stars, and they will inevitably collapse into black holes. And second is that even though the surface at r equal to 0 looks very strange, where time comes to a standstill, nevertheless, for an observer who is falling into a black hole, there is nothing special that happens at this position. I'll try to explain that later in transparency, how this can be. And third is that there are many objects in the sky which are probably black holes, so for which astrophysicists and astronomers have a great evidence, have found great evidence that these objects are black holes. Now, just to explain, so in other words, these objects, these black holes, contain a surface, this surface at which we defined as the black hole radius. This surface is called the horizon. And it's called the horizon because it's a surface such that if you cross it, so if you are traveling and you cross this surface, then you can never come back out. So that's different than any other surface. So if you cross a wall, you can cross it in one direction, you cross it in the other direction. There is nothing that forbids you from doing that. And similarly, if you have a star, you can get close to the star, and then if you have a powerful enough rocket, then you can get further away from the star, and so on. I mean, it might take a powerful enough rocket, but that's fine. You can do that. You can go down with a rope or whatever. So there are many different ways in which you can approach, let's say, the surface of a star, and then go back out, and there is no problem. But if you cross a black hole horizon, then life is not going to be nice for you, because many people, so once you cross it, first of all, you cannot come back out. And second, you are going to be crashed into a singularity. So inevitably, you'll reach a region of high space-time curvature. And this was proven by various theorems of Penrose and also Hawking. So they show that you'll get into a region of very high space-time curvature that will rip you apart. And actually, we don't really, and at this singularity, really the laws of general relativity and the laws of physics as we know them today really cease to be valid, because you get into a regime where the quantum aspects of gravity become very important, and we need a better theory to describe that. But anyway, so that's when you get to the singularity that you need this better theory. When you're at the horizon, nothing terribly special happens. If the black hole is very big, you just cross it and you are fine. So in order just to understand this point a little better, so it's useful to think about space-time as a river, sort of paraphrasing the Greeks who thought time, well, called the river of time and so on. So here we have the river of time, and this is a river that is flowing, and particles are little fish that can swim back and forth, but these fish have the property that they swim at some maximum velocity that we'll call the velocity of light, or the maximum velocity at which fish can swim. Now, suppose you have such a river, and the velocity you are approaching a waterfall, let's say Niagara Falls, and then the velocity of the river gets faster and faster as you get closer to these waterfalls. And let's suppose that at some point the velocity of the water gets faster than the velocity that the fish can swim. So then, so a fish that is on this side of that point, so here the velocity of the water is less than the maximum speed, so the fish can flow upstream or downstream, as they can swim in either direction. On the other hand, if they are here, they can only, even if they swim upstream, they will be going in towards the left, so they will end up in the waterfall, no matter how hard they try to swim. And actually, after some finite time, they will just get into the singularity, get into the waterfall. But for a fish that is swimming in this region, there is nothing really special for the fish at this point. I mean, they only see the water, and they are swimming in the water in different directions. They don't have any reference that tells them that they are going to get into the singularity or anything. So they, so that's what would happen when you cross a horizon. So you not feel anything strange, but your fate is sealed. I should point out that so you should not be very scared of black holes that will swallow you and so on, right? So, I mean, gravity is dangerous. Even if you go to the top of this building, you have to be careful not to fall. And so a black hole is not more dangerous than the top of a building if you are far away. So if you get inside the horizon, then it's more dangerous. But if you're far away, it's not a problem. And in fact, if you replace the sun by a black hole, we will just continue orbiting the same way in the Earth and so on, and there is no reason why we would be swallowed by the black hole. We wouldn't have light, and that would be another problem, but just from gravity, from the gravity point of view, there is nothing special. Anyway, so now let me just mention, the focus of this talk is really on some theoretical aspects of black holes, but since we are talking about black holes, we really have to talk about the black holes we actually think are there in nature. So black holes, as I mentioned, can be formed in astrophysical processes. And so some stars could collapse into black holes. So if they are very massive, they cannot stand the huge gravitational forces. And black holes that are produced in this way are basically of two types. So these are the black holes for which there is some evidence. So there is evidence of black holes that have masses of the order of the mass of a star, so a few times bigger than the mass of the sun. These black holes would have a size of the order of 10 kilometers. That would be their typical sizes. And also we have much bigger black holes, which are black holes typically in the center of galaxies, which have masses of the order of a billion suns, and have sizes of the order of the size of the solar system. So these are huge black holes. Now, how do we see these black holes? So first let me mention in principle how you would see a black hole. So if you had a black hole and it's moving in front of some stars, you would see that the light of the stars that are behind gets gets deformed in a very specific way, and from there you will conclude that there is a black hole. So this is some, this is in principle how we would see it. In practice, that's not how we see them. So in practice, we can see sort of black holes for which there is some other lucky accident, like the black hole is surrounded by some gas, and some gas is falling to the black hole. And this can happen when you have two stars that are very close to each other, so so-called binary stars. And if one of the stars collapses into a black hole, then it can, some of the matter of the other star, some of the gas of the other star, can start falling into this black hole. And as it falls, it orbits the black hole, it heats up, it becomes hotter, and it emits some radiation, some characteristic radiation that we then see. So this radiation is emitted before this matter falls into the horizon, and is giving us a signature of the geometry, the space-time geometry, near this black hole. So this is a picture on the left of some of a star who astronomers believe has a black hole orbiting around it. So there is a big star with, and some matter is falling into a black hole. Now this is a picture of a galaxy. So here at the left we see a galaxy. So this is much bigger scales. So this is the size of typical galaxy. And out of the center of the galaxy, there are powerful streams of particles that produce radiations that people with big radio telescopes measure. And these powerful streams of particles are believed to be analog. So they are believed to be produced by the matter who is falling into a black hole. Some of it gets hit. Some of it hits up. So it's heated up, and some of these particles do not quite fall into the black hole, but are ejected out, and they produce these huge streams of particles. And notice the huge scales we are talking about here. I mean, these streams of particles have sizes of the order of size bigger than the size of the galaxy. And with the Hubble Space Telescope, we can get a closer view at the center of this galaxy, and we see a disk of gas and dust that is falling into the black hole. And this is still very large. This is still much larger than the black hole. So the black hole would be a tiny dot there in the middle. It's still very big, but on the scale of these pictures, it would be much smaller. So these are very powerful black holes. And some astronomers and astrophysicists believe that many big galaxies, such as our own, have a black hole in the center. We only happen to see the ones in which matter is falling in, is actually falling into the black hole. So in our galaxy, apparently there is not much matter falling into the black hole, so we don't see these powerful jets, these powerful streams of particles. But in our galaxies, especially younger galaxies, we do see that. So black holes have a couple of interesting properties. One of them is that they are somehow universal. So stars, we can have all kinds of stars. I mean, we can have yellow stars, blue stars, red stars. They depend on the light from the star depends on the chemical composition and so on. Black holes, once you give the mass, there is just one black hole. You can also give the angular momentum. So, but once you give the mass and how it is rotating, that's it. You fix the black hole, and there is only one black hole for these two parameters. So different types of stars collapse, if they have the same mass, collapse into the same kind of black hole. The second interesting property is the area law, something that Hawking discovered, which is that the area of the horizon always increases. So that doesn't, so if you have a process where you start out with two black holes, and let's say the black holes collide, then if this black hole collides, they could form a bigger black hole, And the bigger black hole doesn't necessarily have a mass that is bigger than the original black hole. Some of the initial energy could be emitted as gravity waves. And actually, by the way, there are some experiments in various places in the world trying to actually detect this type of gravity waves. But anyway, some of the energy could be coming out, so the mass of this one might be smaller than the mass of these two. However, the area of this the area of the final horizon has to be bigger than the sum of the areas of the initial horizons. So this is a result that is very simple to state. Physicists always like results that are simple to state, and it's an important property of black holes. So black holes have always been have been objects that have defied intuition and have led to very interesting surprises. And perhaps one of the most interesting surprises is that black holes are not necessarily black. So we can have white black holes. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, but this is actually what physicists think that could happen. So what happens is that the laws of quantum mechanics imply that black holes can emit some radiation. And I'll explain this point a little better in the next slide, but let me first discuss some of the consequences of this. Let me just explain what is meant by this. So the idea is that as you make a black hole smaller and smaller, the black hole becomes hotter and hotter. So if you start with a very big black hole, it would be a very cold black hole, very black. As you make it smaller, it starts getting hotter. So it gets hot like a piece of charcoal. It becomes red. And it gets even hotter. It will become white. And if you continue, you will emit all kinds of harmful radiation. So you better not do that. Now, for black holes that are very big, like let's say the black hole of a mass of a sun or the black holes that arise through astrophysical processes, this temperature is extremely small. I mean, this is some number, but this is a very, very tiny temperature. And these black holes are not, I mean, this radiation is probably not going to be measured in the foreseeable future. For a black hole of the size of the Earth, the temperature is still very tiny. Maybe you could measure, well, probably also not measurable. And for a black hole that has the mass of a continent, so this is roughly the mass of the continent, let's say the whole North American continent, such a black hole would look white. So this would have a temperature of the order of the temperature that the light bulb has, and this would give you white light. And so we see that black holes can be white, and let me just now explain why this happens, why the laws of quantum mechanics imply this. So the main central point is that in quantum mechanics, the vacuum, empty space, is a state in which lots of things happen. I mean, it looks like there is nothing, but there are all kinds of things going on. In particular, there are particles that are being created, some with positive energy, some with negative energy. They annihilate after a little while. I mean, in ordinary physics, you can't have a particle with negative energy. But if this happens over a time that is very, very tiny, so that you can't actually measure the energy, because there is something called the uncertainty principle that doesn't let you measure energy very precisely if you are talking about very short periods of time. So then you can have all these particles being continuously created and annihilated. And so at long scales, you don't see anything special happening. So these particles get created, get annihilated, nothing gets produced, everybody's fine. Now, in the presence of a horizon, something new can happen, which is that these particles that get continuously created in flat space, one of these particles could escape out, and one other particle could fall into the singularity. And this ordinarily would be forbidden in flat space, because one of the particles would have positive energy, and the other one would have negative energy. And as we said, in flat space, negative energies are not good, are not possible in the theory. I mean, to have them at long times. However, here, in the presence of a black hole, what can happen is that this particle will have negative energy measured from the outside, but the notion of energy here in the interior is different and allows this kind of particle. Because the wait time flow in the interior is slightly different. We said that the time flow comes down to a halt here, and here basically the time flow in the interior is moving in the radial direction. Anyway, so the central point you should get from this description is that you have this continuously this in the vacuum you have this process that occurs continuously, and in the presence of a horizon you have these particles that could go away, and when you do the calculation you can actually find exactly how this radiation comes out, and you find this thermal result that Hawking that I quoted before. So the fact that black holes emit thermal radiation imply that a black hole has a finite lifetime. So normally we think of black holes as sucking everything in and not letting anything out, but we saw that actually that's the picture you get if you use the classical picture of black holes. So if you neglect quantum mechanics, once you take into account quantum mechanics, there is actually stuff that comes out of the black hole. Black holes are hot, they emit thermal radiation, and if the black hole is left there in isolation, and namely if you don't throw anything else into the black hole will eventually start shedding all its energy, will radiate all its energy, and will become smaller and smaller, and eventually will presumably evaporate, it will emit all of its energy. So this process is called black hole evaporation, because this, an analogy to how a droplet of water evaporates and gets smaller. So in similar way, the black hole evaporates and gets smaller and smaller. Now, just to give you an idea of what the timescales involved are, so for a black hole of the mass of the Sun, which are the type of black holes that we have some direct experimental evidence, this lifetime is much longer than the age of the universe. So for these black holes, we don't expect to see Hawking radiation, and we don't expect them to evaporate in the life of the universe. Now, for a black hole of this time is much shorter for a smaller black hole, and in fact, for a black hole of our mass, so a black hole that would have the mass of, let's say, 100 kilograms, this time would be a millisecond. So in this 1 millisecond, all this mass would come out as radiation, and you'd better be very far away, because this is much more energy than in a nuclear explosion. So this, the end points of black hole evaporation are very violent processes. Now, if we had a black hole of the order of the mass of a mountain, then these black holes will evaporate in the age of the universe. So their lifetime is the lifetime of the age of the universe. And this is an interesting mass range, because this might be our only hope for directly experimentally seeing this effect, because the black holes, we have to deal with the black holes that nature produces for us, and the black holes that are produced by usual astrophysical processes have masses much bigger, have masses of the order of mass of the Sun, so they won't not evaporate very quickly. But maybe in the beginning of the universe, if you had produced black holes of this type of masses, maybe now we can see their final stages of their evaporation. This hasn't been seen yet, and it's not known whether such black holes were or were not produced in the beginning of the universe. The most simple theories would predict that they were not produced. Now, independently of whether we actually, of course, once our technology becomes very, very developed, we might eventually be able to produce black holes in the lab with any masses that we want, and then we can study this effect. But these thermal aspects of black holes, independently of whether we are going to measure them or not, lead to very interesting theoretical puzzles. So they are theoretically surprising, and they lead to apparent contradictions, or they lead to apparent problems that we theorists would like to solve. And these problems arise because we are trying to mix gravity and quantum mechanics. So we are trying to mix black holes, which are something intrinsically gravitational, with quantum mechanics, and this leads to some problems. So the two problems I'm going to describe is, one is the problem of the entropy of black holes, and the other one is the problem of information loss. Now, before I talk about entropy, let me just say what entropy is. So for those of you who have never heard the word, so Before we talk about entropy, actually, we'll need to remind you where heat comes from. So our ordinary physical explanation for heat is that it comes from the motion of the microscopic components of the system. So if you have a cold glass of water or a hot glass of water, then in the hot glass of water, the molecules of water are going to be moving much faster than in the cold glass of water. Okay. Now, physicists like to assign a quantity, which they call entropy, which is roughly the number of degrees of freedom in the number of microscopic degrees of freedom. So it's so to explain it more is, so heat comes from the motion of the microscopic components, and then if you give some energy to the system, these microscopic components will move more and the temperature will rise. But how much more they would move depends on how many microscopic components you have. Because once you supply some energy, this energy might need to be distributed among more particles. And so the more particles you have, the more heat you need to give in order to raise the temperature. So there is some law, some physical law, which is called the first law of thermodynamics, that tells you what the number of microscopic components is. And you can compute it by doing sort of thermodynamic measurements, how people compute this quantity in the lab. And here in this context, we can compute it because we know what the temperature is for a given mass. So we can compute this this quantity, which is the entropy. And this was computed by Bekenstein and Hawking. And they found that the area, the entropy, is the area of the horizon divided by the Newton constant. So this combination is some length scale, so some minimal area, which is very important in the theory of quantum gravity. It's a combination of the constant of gravity and the Planck constant, which is the constant of quantum mechanics. And this length scale is, you can think of it as the minimal length scale that you can have in a quantum theory of gravity. And it's a very tiny length scale. It's of order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So that's an extremely small length scale. It's much smaller than any distance we can measure today. And this implies that this is a very large entropy. So for a black hole of, let's say, macroscopic size, this entropy is terribly big. So saying that there are a lot of degrees of freedom in a black hole. So black holes are intimately related to the structure of space-time. Because black holes are fundamentally gravitational, they're independent of what kind of matter forms them, and they should be explained by a theory of quantum gravity. I mean, and this entropy, roughly speaking, should come from the microscopic motion of the different elementary constituents, or let's say atoms, of space-time geometry, so the fundamental objects that make space and time. I mean, here the word atoms is an analogy, of course. An atom is much bigger than these objects we are talking about. But this would be the really fundamental unit of space and time. So understanding black holes is really understanding also the nature of space and time. So that was the first problem, so the problem of the entropy of black holes. There is also another problem, which is the problem of information loss in black holes. And this basically is the following thing. So we can form a black hole in different ways. So different stars can collapse into black holes, or we can throw different books into a black hole, and they disappear behind the horizon. And the black hole seems to operate always in the same way, always emits the same kind of thermal radiation that you can compute, and it's independent of what you threw in. And so this, at first sight, seems OK, that's fine. I mean, you throw something, something comes out, that's fine. But the laws of quantum mechanics says that what comes out shouldn't be independent of what you throw in. So the quantum mechanics is a theory where you preserve information. So if you give some information in the beginning, that you should be able to extract the same information at the end of your process. Now, it might not be very easy to extract this information. So for example, if you take a book and you burn it, it would be pretty hard to take the information of the book. But in principle, according to laws of quantum mechanics, you didn't lose this information. I mean, if you recovered all the photons and all the particles that came out of the book, and you solved all the equations of quantum mechanics, presumably you could get it, at least in principle. In practice, of course, impossible, but in principle, you could. But here, we are faced with a situation where we seem to get that even in principle, you are losing the information. So it looks like quantum mechanics would have to be replaced by another theory where you can lose information, okay? If this was true. Now, many of these questions can be studied using string theory. I won't be able to describe what string theory is, but string theory, the main claim to fame of string theory is that it's a theory of quantum gravity that allows you to put together quantum mechanics and gravity. It's really a theory under construction, so we don't know the full theory, we know many aspects of it. And it's called string theory because some excitations can be, in some limits, the theory has excitations which are tiny loops of energy or tiny strings. The theory also has some other objects called D-brains and so on. I won't get into the details of what they are, but the fundamental thing is that it's a theory that has precise mathematical rules that govern the behavior of all these different objects. And knowing these mathematical rules, you can do some computations. So you can consider black holes in string theory, and in some lucky some simple cases, you can actually have configurations which look like black holes, and then you can tune some parameters and make them into a collection of D-brains and strings. So in other words, you can think of the black holes as a collection of the objects that you have in string theory. These objects are governed by precise mathematical rules, and you can count how many possible ways you can arrange these objects. And when you do that, then you find that the entropy is the number of ways of arranging this object. So these objects are like the fundamental quanta or quanta of space-time that are making the black hole. Now, a property, an interesting aspect of black holes, or the formula, that formula we saw for the entropy, is that the entropy is proportional to the area and not to the volume. So in ordinary physics, when we compute the entropy or the energy of a glass of water, this entropy is proportional to the volume, not the area. The number of degrees of freedom, the number of atoms we need to describe the water, is proportional to the volume and not to the area. Now, in quantum gravity is supposed to have the very weird and strange property that the number of degrees of freedom to describe the entropy in some region, the number of degrees of freedom to describe completely a region of space-time grows like the area of the region and not like the volume of the region. So this is a very strange property. And this is called holography because in an optical hologram is a two-dimensional surface which encodes the information about the three-dimensional shape of the object. So it's the word here is just an analogy, but this is a very surprising and strange property. Now, interestingly enough, in string theory, we can actually realize this very concretely. So there are some particular space-times that I'm going to describe in a second. And we can describe the whole physics of these space-times in terms of a theory on the boundary. And this theory on the boundary is not some weird, strange theory. It's actually a theory that we knew all along. So these are theories that are very similar to the theories that describe elementary particles. But it's a theory that does not contain gravity. So this works very nicely in some spaces that have negative curvature. Now, spaces of negative curvature might not be very familiar, but this is a picture that Escher drew. This is a famous Dutch painter from the beginning of the century. He was fascinated with geometry, and he asked, well, what are the simplest geometries that you have? So, well, the simplest geometries are, for example, flat space. So we are all used to flat space. We're also used to the surface of the sphere. So that's the simplest two-dimensional positively curved surface. So that has positive curvature. Now, if you take the surface of the sphere and you try to project it on the plane, you'll get some deformation, right? You can't do that very faithfully. And we are very familiar with that. That's just a world map, right? So if you look at the world map, that's a projection of the two-dimensional surface of the Earth on the two-dimensional plane. Now, hyperbolic space is the simplest space with negative curvature. If you take that space and you project it onto the plane, this would be the map. This would be a map of hyperbolic space where you have filled in hyperbolic space with some tiles. And all these tiles are these different fish, and they all have the same size. So they all have the same physical size, the same size on hyperbolic space. When we project them onto the plane, there is some distortion due to the projection, similar to the distortion that happens usually in Antarctica, in the North and South Pole, when you project the surface of the sphere onto the plane. So that usually happens in world maps. So here it's happening in the faraway region of hyperbolic space. So hyperbolic space is infinitely big, big in this direction. So there is an infinite number of fish when you get to this that we call the boundary. And so that's a picture. Now, in the same way that we can have a negatively curved space, we can have a negatively curved space-time. So we add time now. And so negatively curved space-time is just at each moment in time, we have the space we just mentioned, except but with more dimensions, of course. This was two-dimensional, but this would be a three-dimensional space. And then in addition, we have time. So this looks like a very esoteric space-time, but it's actually very natural. It's the simplest generalization. It's the simplest curved space-time. So the simplest space-time is flat space. The next simplest is this one with negative curvature. And there is another one with positive curvature also. But we're going to talk about the one with negative curvature. So these negatively curved space-times have the feature that a particle here in the center, so if you put a particle here in the center, it will just stay in the center. If you kick it a little bit, it will oscillate around the center. So a particle here sitting at the center will feel as if this particle has he's at the center of a gravitational field that attracts everything to that observer. So if the observer is sitting there, he feels everything is attracted to him or her, and if he throws a particle, it comes back to them, and so on. So if you shoot a gun in anti-sitter space, you are going to be in trouble. So as you are if you shoot it anywhere else. So you shouldn't do that. Now, for a massless particle or a particle that propagates at the speed of light, situation is slightly different. So this particle can go all the way to infinity and back in finite time from this point of view. Now, this might look very surprising to you because I told you that this is an infinite distance. So how can the light go to infinite distance and back? And this is one of the surprising properties of curved spacetimes. What happens is that, again, the flow of time is different here than here. And here, time flows very, very fast. So that's why it can go. So for this, just 1 second passed. But for an observer here, well, an infinite amount of time passed. So that's roughly what happens. So we have this space, and it has an interior, and it has a boundary. So this region very far away. So you should imagine you are in this is some negatively curved space. If the curvature is very small, this will look like, I don't know, the space inside this room. And then you go far away, everything is attracted to the center, and so on. And so this boundary is some region very far away. And the idea is that the gravitational physics in the interior can be described in terms of a theory of particles, an alternative theory of particles that lives on the boundary. So let's suppose we have some particle here in the interior, and there will be some particles, different kinds of particles living on the boundary that give an equivalent description to this particle. So either we can think of this as some object in a gravitational theory and so on, or we can think in terms of some particles on the boundary. Now, the advantage of this description is that it can describe arbitrarily complicated objects in principle. So in principle, it's going to give us a description of, for example, a black hole in the interior. So a black hole in the interior is, again, some configurations of particles on the boundary. And the entropy of the black hole is just the entropy of the particles. So it's all the possible ways of arranging these particles in such a way that you have a black hole. And one nice feature of this description is that it shows explicitly that such black holes do not have any you don't have the problem of information loss. And the reason is that the theory of these particles on the boundary is just an ordinary quantum mechanics theory that physicists have studied a lot and which does not show any information loss, and therefore obeys the laws of quantum mechanics, and so it does not have information loss. So this is a very different way of describing space-time. And it gives a completely different picture of space-time in which initially you start out with a theory of particles here living only on the boundary. And out of this interaction of the particles, these particles are strongly interacting. They interact with each other. And the best way of describing the effective dynamics that results from these interactions is to say that you actually have particles moving in one higher dimension. So in some way, the space-time in the interior is an approximate concept that comes out of the interactions of all the particles in the boundary. So this is similar to the way in which if you have the surface of it of let's say a lake or the surface of the water in your glass of water that we discussed before, that surface seems to be very well defined and very clear object from the classical point of view. But in the more quantum mechanical description, this is not a very well defined surface. There are constantly atoms leaving the surface and coming back to the surface, and in a precise way we cannot really define the surface. So it only comes out of the interactions of all the atoms of all the molecules of water, and only then, when we consider the system at long scales and so on, can we talk about this as a well-defined surface. So we are getting a very similar picture here of just space-time geometry. That space-time geometry arises from the interaction of some more fundamental degrees of freedom and living on the boundary. Now here I pasted in here this picture of the Andromeda galaxy, but we don't know yet whether we can apply this to describe our own universe, because our own universe is not negatively curved. Actually, it's more closely related to a positively curved space. And for those, we don't yet have the we don't yet know what the more precise description of those spaces is. But presumably something like this might be true. And this is thinking about those spacetimes, of course, is one of the main activities that is going on now in among some string theorists and some theoretical physicists. And it's one of the activities that goes on here in Perimeter Institute. And hopefully we'll soon have a description that would be good for expanding spacetimes, such as our own. And the advantage of such a description would be that the Big Bang would not be a singularity, would not be something that we cannot describe. The Big Bang would be something that we could understand precisely. In the same way that black holes are something that we can understand precisely through these methods. So here we can describe the black hole completely viewed from the outside. So there is no problem, there is a singularity in the interior. We can describe perfectly well the black holes are seen from the outside using these methods. So I hope I conveyed to you that black holes are fascinating objects, and that whereas the effects of space-time curvature are very large, black holes combined with quantum mechanics have provided us with very interesting challenges to our understanding of quantum gravity, and it's a very good testing ground of theory of quantum gravity. And string theory has led us to some very precise and interesting description of black holes. It has shown very clearly that there is no information loss, and they have shown that even so, in the beginning of string theory, the only processes that could be described in string theory were simple ripples of space-time, very small ripples of space-time that collided and so on, like colliding gravitational waves. But now we know how to describe more complicated things like black holes or more highly curved spaces. And all these descriptions are leading to a very interesting and not fully understood ways of describing space-time, where space-time arises as an effective concept, not as something more fundamental. Okay, thank you very much.